George?
John?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good. It's been a while.
Yeah, and you've been traveling and were stuck in some big storm in the Midwest, or what happened to you?
Yeah, I spent the night in at the Chicago airport. Well, fortunately at a Chicago airport hotel, but... You know, actually, that was, you know, one of the highlights of the trip. I was glad to be snowed in because I got a chance to sleep after a 12-hour flight from Spain.
Spain? What were you doing over there?
Yeah, it was part of this research I'm doing on solar energy.
Uh-huh.
And I won't talk about that too much since I'm going to be writing about it, but I was in Germany and Spain, and, you know, Germany, unsurprisingly, you know, it snowed the entire time, and then I got down to southern Spain, to Sevilla, uh-huh. and Andalusia, and it was beautiful, but it was, you know, uncharacteristically bad weather for that time of year.
So not much sunshine during your solar energy trip.
No, yeah, very little solar energy was impinging on Andalusia. But, oh, it's beautiful country, and I have, you know, have many memories that I'll be thinking about for years, and like being in Granada in the snow and looking out the hotel window at the Alhambra, the old Muslim palace, and it's just beautiful. But I have to say, it's maybe one of the, in many ways, the worst, most stressful, you know, comedy of errors kind of trip I've been on ever in my life. I was the victim again and again, mostly of technology, of bad technology.
That sounds like
if you indulge me, I'll give you a few examples.
Sounds like a portent for our time.
It does, yes. The world is falling apart. The center cannot hold. And
yeah, doesn't it seem that way? You know, just I think it was yesterday, I called Karen Wright. You know, Karen, the science, wonderful
Karen,
science journalist.
Wow.
And
so we should say for those who aren't aware of her fame, that she's a prominent science writer and an old friend, and she was your colleague at Scientific American, right?
We started on exactly the same day in the fall of 1986 at Scientific American.
That was a really interesting group of people back then.
It was.
You know, that was just when I'd moved to New York, and I can't remember. I guess I met June Kinoshita first, and through her I met you and Karen and a bunch of other really interesting people.
Tim Appenzeller, who's now at National Geographic.
Tim Appenzeller, National Geographic, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Karen, I called Karen to chat about something. I forget what it was. And it turned out I sort of hadn't thought about it. I should have realized that she was right in the middle of one of the most horrific ice storms, I guess, in the history of the country, which hit New Hampshire last week. So we got this torrential rain down here, and I guess you just went a little bit north and it turned to freezing rain and it coated all the trees, and Karen said it was like an atomic bomb went off. There were so many trees that were shattered by the weight of ice on them, and so she hasn't had power in about 6 days, and there's no prospect of getting it anytime soon because
it was so off the scale that they
so they've actually brought in crews from Canada and all over the Northeast United States to help out, and still it's going so slowly. And it just struck me that, I don't know, it seems as though calamities, we shouldn't dwell on this because as you might have read recently, there's a new study showing that happiness is contagious, and of course the inverse is true. Unhappiness and despair are also contagious, but it does seem like calamities are, there's this sort of fractal quality to the calamities that are striking us lately that just seem to be happening.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, so here, first of all, our profession is imploding, and it's just accelerated recently, but then there's the collapse of the global economy. Then there's this natural disaster of the kind that Karen is struggling with. I know people who are dealing with mini calamities in their workplace or families. I'm going to a funeral this afternoon, in fact. for a dad of one of my son's friends. So it's I don't know. It's
oh, yeah, that's sad.
It's just kind of.
You don't think it's all related, though, do you? I mean, some of it obviously is, like the economic calamity is a huge factor in, you know, the what seems to be the implosion or at least the realignment of the journalism industry. And but of course, that's also related to you know, changing technologies and the web and all that. But,
yeah. Well, no.
The ice storm.
It's just that. It creates this. I mean, of course, it's subjective, and then you start sort of looking at these events and connecting the dots, even when there isn't a connection. And you have this feeling that the you know, the gods are just messing with you.
You know, turn on Pat Robertson's 700 Club and hear about, you know, how these are all you know, prophesied in the Bible, and it shows that the end times are coming, and we can look forward to the rapture. Or not us personally, but they can look forward to the rapture. And,
we can look forward.
You know, we'll never be bored again.
What's the opposite of the rapture? The
The tribulation.
The tribulation,
7 years of tribulation, you know, fire and brimstone, hell on earth, and you know, since we didn't get with the program,
and
it's not
and
too
plummeting
late.
Plummeting 401k portfolios.
Oh yeah.
Anyway.
Well, mine were many calamities, but you know, of course, they're magnified when you're traveling by yourself, and even in some places civilized as Germany and Spain, but. I don't know, maybe this will sound trivial when I recount it, but just imagine you've been driving for, it must have been, I don't know, hours and hours from Freiburg, Germany, south on the Autobahn, and, you know, you finally get to the Frankfurt airport to drop off the rental car.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, driving on the Autobahn is horrible. It was snowing or raining the entire time, and then there's all these, you know, really aggressive Nazi-like young German men and their black BMWs that are
George,
cutting you off and zooming past you. That was a terrible thing to say, but
yeah, you're going
to
catch hell for that comment.
Well, you know what I mean. You know,
they're
like the aggressive German businessmen who are you know, just as bad as aggressive American businessmen, except they're on the Autobahn with a BMW and a huge engine and, you know, blowing you away as they. Go by at 100 miles an hour. So anyway, that was my mood, fair or not. So I get finally to the airport, and I'm, you know, refilling the tank to drop off the rental card, and the diesel dispensing machine rejects my credit card.
Uh-oh.
So I think, oh, well, you know, this isn't good. And there's no attendant because it's entirely automated.
Ah.
So I have to return the rental car with an empty tank, which, of course, ends up costing, like, you know, $100 extra or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this huge surcharge. So then I go, oh, well, you know, what the hell. So I get to my airport hotel where I'm staying before flying to Spain the next day, and then I want to get on the internet to try to figure out what happened, you know, with my credit card. So, of course, I need to use the credit card number to pay for the internet connection, and it rejects my credit card.
There's something
I get out my credit card, and I, you know, I see they have a number where it says, you know, there's the 800 number, of course, for the U.S., and then there's the number, this is like Chase Bank Visa card, and it says, you know, you can call collect if you're traveling overseas and have trouble. So I, you know, I try to place a collect call with an international operator, and they say, no, we can't place a collect call to that number, and it's never really explained why. So finally, you know, all I can do is, I don't use cell phones that much. I take, you know, like I had a pay-as-you-go cell phone with me, and I didn't want to get stuck on hold for, like, you know, 20 minutes, eating up my minutes. So I made a direct call to Visa,
mm-hmm.
you know, to see what was going on. And then the first thing the woman asked me, you know, she's looking at my record, and she says, well, you know, I don't see any record here that you told us that you were going to be traveling in Germany. For Spain.
What?
I said, what?
Since
you
when?
Mean, you think I'm supposed to call you up if I'm going to another country and ask your permission or inform you? She says, well, yes, it's a good idea. And anyway, what happened was the computer, you know, that they use this pattern matching algorithms that are supposedly trained to find suspicious behavior.
Yeah.
And something that I had done had triggered the computer system, you know, the artificial unintelligence, and they put a block on my credit card.
Uh-huh.
And at no time, you know, no one ever tried to call me or send me an email. I checked later. Absolutely no notice whatsoever. So then I had to get the security block removed. So, you know, it took two telephone calls to do this, and, you know, a total of, you know, it was about, I guess it was like 30, 40 euros, you know, to call, you know, direct, you know, dial from a from a hotel. So that was really annoying, but, you know, I figured, well, you know, gotten through that. So anyway, this just kept being a recurring theme. So I'm down in Andalusia, and I'm trying to check out of my hotel in Cadiz.
Uh-huh.
And that rejects my credit card.
Oh, no.
So, you know, again, I call, and, you know, I'm sure they've put on another security hold, and I'm really mad, and they say, no, we don't see any hold here at all. There's no reason why this shouldn't be going through. So the hotel keeps trying it. It keeps getting rejected. So finally, this is taking like an hour, I, you know, go through all the, you know, all the hoops at Visa on a long distance, another long distance hotel call, and I finally get it escalated to, like, you know, a real high level supervisor. And meanwhile, as I'm doing this on the phone, I'm escalating at the hotel desk to get the manager of the hotel there. I'm putting him on the phone with Visa, and they're saying, no, the credit card's fine, and he's running the credit card through again and again, and it keeps being rejected. And they're saying, no, it's not even showing up in our computer. Now, you'd think at this point, you have Visa on one line, you have the hotel manager on the other line, you have me who can pick up, you know, the phone on an extension, and we can say, well, hey, you know, this is the charge, this is the card, is everything fine? And they say, yes, please do this, we can give you an authorization number, 307166, and then you'd be on your way.
Mm-hmm.
But no, you can't do this anymore. It's impossible to do it manually.
The machine rules.
It has to be done by machine, or they don't consider it a transaction. So at this point, I'm imagining myself in the Cadiz jail, or, I mean, maybe some of our listeners know, but I'd be curious to know what would have happened if I just at some point said, fuck this, and left.
Yeah.
Got in my rental car and drove away.
Oh, that probably would have been a bad idea in a foreign country.
Come to think of it, I had to get a token to get out of the parking garage, so they had me trapped. Anyway, I ended up walking half a mile to a cash machine thinking, oh, God, what if I can't get cash on my ATM card? And fortunately, that network wasn't impaired, so I got cash, paid for cash, left. So the next thing, you know, the next night, the same thing happened in Granada.
Oh,
exactly,
God.
The same thing.
Well, you know, I wonder if this is related to the credit crisis, if the credit cards are sort of adding extra red flag criteria.
Well, it's definitely an example of, in this case, Chase Bank. You know, one thing they try to tell you when you call customer service is that they're doing this for your protection.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and of course it's not for your protection at all. They're obligated under federal law to make good on any fraudulent activity on the credit card if you identify it and, you know, if you report it within some period of time. So they're completely covering themselves, and then they're doing it at the expense of their customers. So
I think it's the...
You know, I mean, what if I'd been traveling in Ethiopia or something?
I think we are headed... You know, I'm surprised Susie didn't have more trouble, given what you're describing, when she's in Tanzania. I don't know how much she used her credit card. But it strikes me that...
I'm just going to take envelopes of cash from now on.
I would think... we are headed for an era of really crappy customer service because there are massive layoffs in all industries. The people who are left are terrified and overworked.
Naturally, their attitude's going to be worse and worse because at any point they can get laid off and they're working in this minimal skeleton staff.
So they're just going to be covering their asses in any way possible. So, I think this definitely is a portent, George.
I think it is, and it's all related to the global credit crisis.
Yeah.
So you can see indirectly how it could be. But it's also, you know, just technology, you know, just the old cliche about becoming too dependent on it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in addition to all this, I had another experience where I tried to take out 300 euros on my ATM card at a train station in Sevilla. And, you know, it grinds away for, you know, what seems like 5 minutes. And obviously it's trying very hard to dispense the cash, but it just, you know, can't do it. So it says, sorry, transaction malfunctioned, and then I get a little slip of paper saying that no cash was dispensed. So I thought, oh, well, good, at least the computer system knows this. So then later in the day, I try three or four more ATMs trying to get cash, and they all reject my card.
Because
so then I call my bank in Santa Fe, and they look at it, and they say, oh, well, that's because you already took out 300 euros, which on that day was about $400 at the train station in Sevilla.
Oh, shit.
But this time, though, it's my nice local bank, and they say, well, you know, we'll have to file a dispute when you get home, but meanwhile, we'll increase your limit to $1,000 a day, if that'll do it.
Wow, sounds like you spent more time talking to banks on this trip than you did talking to solar energy experts.
That's how it was starting to seem. And, okay, I'm just going to give you one final example. I was using, for the first or second time in my life, a GPS.
Uh-huh.
You know, I bought a Garmin GPS with European maps.
Yeah, cool.
And first it was just hilarious. When I was in Germany, I was traveling part of the time with an assistant for translation and dealing with German bureaucracy and things.
Wow.
You know, this is for National Geographic.
This
and
is
they
big
have these
time.
People that, yeah, they have people they call fixers.
Uh-huh.
I'd never heard this term before. And this is someone who used to work on the photo desk at National Geographic and has recently moved to Berlin and is German born. And the first thing was, it was just hilarious listening to the voice on the GPS trying to pronounce German street names.
Uh-huh.
And it was just so bad, she just kept cracking up. It was just a terrible pronunciation. And finally, I figured you could change the settings so it would speak in German, but then it doesn't even tell you the street names. It just tells you to turn right in 300 meters or something.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, that was just kind of amusing. And then in Spain, it was so bad that even I could tell the Spanish pronunciation was so terrible that I put it in Spanish so I could practice my Spanish. But anyway, I'm in this little town called Utrera, which is what I'm supposed to be doing is I just come back from Cadiz after this horrible credit card experience, and I'm supposed to pick up the National Geographic fixer in Spain at the train station there, and then we're going to go on to Granada,
because
mm-hmm. There's a big solar site near there. So anyway, I get there early, and then I find a place to park in the center of town. And like most of these little towns, if you walk around to the top of the hill, you find a castle and some really cool old architecture. Then I get back in the car, and I set it to, take me to the train station in Utrera. So first, I'm just really impressed because it actually knows how to do this. So I start following the turns, and it brings me to a traffic circle, and I'm supposed to take the second exit off the traffic circle. But it turns out the traffic circle has been half demolished because of construction.
Uh-oh.
So I take another turn. And, when you use these GPS devices, if you get off path, the voice, there's this woman who gets completely exasperated with you. She goes, recalculating. So she was saying this in Spanish. I forget how you say recalculating.
Does she
and
sigh
sent me
loudly?
Down this other. So she sent me up or down, told me to turn down this extremely narrow street. And this is an old Spanish town, what they call the Pueblos Blancos, with the whitewashed walls and the narrow, windy little streets.
Uh-huh.
So it's this one-way street. And then I barely squeeze by because they're also doing construction, and there's this big construction dumpster in someone's car. I get down to the bottom, and it turns out that it leads to the traffic circle at exactly the spot that's been demolished. So now I'm stuck at the bottom of this what's become a cul-de-sac, and I try, a dozen times to back up, and I can't get the car angled right. So, I just imagine any second I'm going to hear ripping metal as I get too close to this dumpster. I mean, obviously it was physically possible to get past here, but it was just, you had to be exactly aligned, apparently, to do it. Then you get flustered, and you don't just turn on your zen-like backing up skills. And so finally I had to, this nice Spanish couple came by, and they spoke much less English than I spoke Spanish, and finally with gestures and things they realized what happened. He tried to direct me, and that didn't work, and finally he just, in exasperation, tells me to get out of the car. So he gets in the car, backs it up the street. It turns out he actually lived on the street. Then he tells me to get in. His wife gets in the car, and then he drives me to the train station and parks.
Gee, thank God for humans.
Really nice guy. Boy, I was just, I thought, wow, nothing worse can happen than this. And then there was more credit card stuff. So,
you know,
anyway, that's my example of in my, needing to absorb this by complaining about it and
Oh, Jesus, George, in the context
of our technologies are failing us.
If I were you, I would be getting paranoid that the machines, the information network that's controlling the world out there has put you on its shit list, and it's just, you know...
That is exactly how I felt.
And it's just decided to torment you in all these kind of subtle ways, so you can't really be sure that there is a malevolent force out to get you, but it just really feels that way.
Yeah, it's like I shouldn't watch The Terminator for a while, because that'll just feed my paranoia.
And there's a new one coming out. Yeah, what this reminds me of, though, is I'm sure you must have had this sensation. You're sometimes doing a story, and you're taking a business trip and going to a laboratory and interviewing people, and there's sort of that narrative that you put together for your newspaper or magazine or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. and then there's the real narrative that takes place. There's always a whole other story that you could tell, but you don't tell about what has happened to you because it doesn't fit within the framework of the publication and science journalism in general.
Right. So someone will read when I eventually do this story on solar energy and about visiting all these solar sites and talking to these really interesting scientists and engineers and things like this, and they won't realize that all this agony that was going on in this, the background.
That's right. They will just simply assume, they'll have this image of you as this incredibly efficient information gathering machine.
Oh yeah, right, and very cosmopolitan as I, negotiate the back streets of Andalusia.
I've sometimes thought about writing these things up. So I did an article about 5 years ago for Discover magazine on an experience I had in Navajo Nation taking.
Oh, I remember that. That was really
peyote.
Good.
Well, it was.
Yeah, you worked some of that kind of stuff into the story.
Well, but there was a lot that I didn't work into the story. So actually, I went out there with this Harvard psychiatrist named John Halpern, who was doing this multi-year study of the effects of peyote on members of the Native American Church. He wanted to see if it caused any kind of brain damage or cognitive deficits and so forth. And he had arranged for both of us to be part of this ceremony that was going to be led by a major person in the Native American Church. And that fell through. There was miscommunication. This guy wasn't where he was supposed to be. And so we found ourselves at about 8 o'clock on a Saturday night just trying to find a peyote ceremony to crash. And we ended up driving around these hardscrabble towns.
This was on the Navajo Reservation?
Yeah. And
like Tuba City or Kayenta?
I forget that. Tuba City sounds familiar, but these are really poor towns, and we're looking for a teepee, which is where they erect teepees for these ceremonies. They're generally held on Saturday nights. They start about 8:30 or 9. They have a fire that they build inside, and we were just desperately driving around trying to find a peyote ceremony, and then we were going to ask the people, these strangers, if we could join their ceremony. And there were actually three of us: John Halpern, the psychiatrist, myself, and then this guy named Kailash Kokapelli, who was a traveling German minstrel who just roamed around the world.
So you didn't have anyone who was Navajo with you?
No.
Wow.
And
that takes some gall to try to crash a peyote ceremony.
And I was just, I thought the whole idea was stupid. I just thought my assignment has fallen through. I was really bumming out, and I was really mad, to be honest, at Halpern, because I felt like he had really, screwed this up, and I'd spend all of Discover Magazine's money to fly out there, and driving around and just trying to invite ourselves into a ceremony seemed like a really stupid thing. But then we found a teepee with all these people milling around, preparing for a ceremony, and Kailash turned out to be the perfect person to get us invited, because he had this flute and he said he wanted to listen to their songs, and he was really interested in the ceremony, and so he talked us, he talked these people into letting us stay. So I spent the evening with about 20 Navajo complete strangers. And of course, none of this made it into the...
Oh, this is so much better than what you planned.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I also left out the fact that right in the middle of the ceremony, I was sitting next to... Halpern was on my right, and Kailash Kokapelli was on my left. Mm-hmm. And he... obviously, this was an assumed name. Kokapelli is the
well,
sort of,
yeah, that's the... Yeah.
It's the...
It's the little... The flute... The little god-like creature that's shown punched over playing the flute or the pipe. And
yeah, in some Indian...
People must have gotten the mistaken impression that this is an important, you know, symbol and, you know, for the Southwest Native American community, but it's...
Well, so Kailash had assumed this name, but anyway, we're in the middle of the ceremony, we're passing around the peyote tea and peyote chunks and so forth, and I'm just trying to still grok the fact that we have basically barged into this incredibly personal ceremony. And then...
They're very gracious, then.
They were extremely gracious, which even made it worse, because I'm thinking, here we are, we're the, you know, the white people who've committed genocide and destroyed their way of...
Yeah, there's just something... Navajo culture is really... There's some very... Very wonderful warmth to it, and just a wonderful sense of humor.
Yeah, but I was by this time I was getting really high, and I was getting extremely paranoid. And then I look to my left, and I see Kailash. He's looking at me, and his eyes are bugging out. And I'm assuming that he's having some kind of transcendent revelation. And and we're staring into each other's eyes, and suddenly his cheeks start bulging. And I realize that he's about to vomit.
He's throwing up.
And he suddenly spews vomit all the way across the teepee. And then he wanted...
How did your host react to that?
Well, it was interesting, because then he was so mortified, he jumped up and he wanted to run out of the teepee. And there's this guy who was the fire tender who was right in the middle of the teepee. And he went over and shoved Kailash back down, and he kind of was making hand signals and saying, "Don't worry about it, it's cool." And then he had this special instrument for scraping up the vomit and tossing it outside the teepee. It turned out that this was a part of this
part of the ceremony.
Yeah,
It
was very.
Yeah, I'd heard
common.
That peyote makes you extremely sick, right?
Yeah, fortunately I didn't get sick.
Well, you're an old hand at that point.
That's right. But then there was this woman who was one of the central figures in the ceremony. There was a family that had all these problems, a young mother and dad and their two very young children, and the ceremony had been called to try to help them deal with their problems, and the woman got violently ill in the middle of the ceremony, too.
Mm.
And the guy... in the center, again, took care of it in this very sort of meticulous way. But no, none of that made it into the Discover article either.
That's terrible. Yeah. Oh, that would have been so great. Did you try to write it in?
I didn't
get past the editor, or did you just know that...
You've only got 3,000 words. Article was really about the revival of psychedelic research and all this other research other people were doing. And
yeah, Discover wouldn't have been the forum in which you could do that.
Yeah,
It would have been great. You know, lately I've been reading, for the first time I've been reading David Foster Wallace.
Yeah.
You know, who since he committed suicide tragically... And I haven't read his fiction, but I didn't even know that he was known for his nonfiction. And I'm reading his essays, and it seems almost absurd to call them essays because that sounds so mannered.
Yeah.
Compared to the wildness, but you know, he was just this wonderful God. He's just a wonderful nonfiction writer.
Well, yeah,
and the way he would, you know, and the way he has kind of the license or a forum to integrate what he's reporting about with the act of reporting, and you know, it's the old new journalism Tom Wolfe thing, kind of reborn in the 1990s and early 2000s, and a lot of people try this, but he really pulls it off.
Yeah, he really was an interesting character. I mean, he wrote this whole book on, I think this is one of his last books, on Infinity.
Right.
I guess he had this fascination.
Yeah, Cantor and the Cantor sets and all of that. And
which is interesting
and studied
because...
studied mathematics and philosophy.
Yeah, and Cantor was... I think Cantor committed suicide also.
Mm.
As I recall, and the story was that he was sort of driven mad by excessive contemplation of infinity.
Yeah, yeah.
But, it's...
Oh, yeah, it's just great stuff. I think he's much better than Hunter S. Thompson, who just, would just be so self-indulgent. It was just kind of... You kind of got to where you didn't trust it.
He became a parody of himself. I think all that drinking and drugs... takes its toll.
Yeah, but Wallace's, at the same time, he doesn't, there's some of the attitude, but at the same time, there's this sincerity that comes through that, really trying to understand and appreciate something that's absolutely bizarre. Or we had one essay about 9/11 and watching it on television at a neighbor's house in the small town in Illinois where he lived, and yes, just the description of what he's seeing and the absurdity of seeing this tragedy on television. It's just brilliant, brilliant writing.
Yeah. Well, journalism, when you read somebody like that, you realize just how many possibilities there are in journalism. I think
that's really what it's been. It's just been inspiring to me. Just to remember that, and I've been reading Joan Didion again too. Just the really good non-fiction stylists. And
Play It As It Lays, or what was her classic about?
That was a novel, Slouching Toward Bethlehem.
Toward Bethlehem.
Yeah, it's this essay on Haight-Ashbury in the late 1960s, I guess 1967.
Yeah,
that's just amazing. Or there's this one, Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream, about this bizarre murder case that took place around Los Angeles. But, science.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so part of the reason I'm rambling so much is I'm still jet-lagged.
Hey, you're doing fine.
Thanks.
So we've got a responsibility today.
Oh, yeah, there's some kind of little quid pro quo thing.
That we're going to try out.
Can you explain that?
Well, it's, Blogging Heads is looking for arrangements with other media outlets that can get some cross traffic going. And so we are going
HBO,
to...
HBO, right?
Pardon me?
Did you got to deal with HBO?
HBO, yeah.
No?
It's not quite at that. No, it's something much better than HBO. It's something Science Blogs, which is a family of blogs published by Seed Magazine. And that's where Carl Zimmer used to blog, but then he just switched over to... Discover, but it's got, among others, P.Z. Myers, who I think still has the most popular science-related blog.
Yeah, he's the most popular.
And he's been on blogging as a
couple
of
times. I knew about
the
individual blogs, but I guess I didn't realize there was like a Science Blog Central.
Yeah, they've got, I think, dozens of people blogging there.
Yeah.
And so
I looked at it when we were told about this, just to see what it looked like. So I guess they collect all these blogs, and then there's little excerpts, so it's kind of a portal to get into science blogs. I'm not really sure what purpose that serves, but anyway, if it helps increase our small audience, that's okay.
Well, I think the deal is that we will discuss something that's been posted on science blogs in our conversations, and then they will post a link to that segment of our conversation and something along those lines. And so anyway...
Yeah, well, it can't hurt.
Yeah, and, you know, they actually
have... And then to do this, we're supposed to do something for them, right?
Well, yeah, we're going to talk about one of their stories, and then we'll have a link to that post.
So that'll bring some of our traffic over there, maybe.
Yeah, the synergy of the entities.
Yeah, I guess no money changes hands in these things.
No, that world is gone, George.
Yeah, this new paradigm will soon affect other industries beyond journalism, I think, where everyone will be expected to work for free.
Right, and, there will just be all this mutual back-scratching going on, but no actual revenues.
Yeah, like your accountant will have to do your taxes for free, and, as a result, she'll get to, be on a blog or something, and, I don't know how this is all going to work, but it seems like somewhere someone's going to have to make some money. But
it's a good. We can at least kill some time.
Yeah. So you wanted to talk about there was a blog posting by PZ Myers. About that brain study.
Yeah.
Brain scanning. Thing.
And actually, this I've been tracking this whole area of brain scans and electrodes in the brain and, they can and cannot tell us about what's going on in our minds.
Yeah.
This was pretty remarkable.
What did the study do? What exactly was the
result? Well, it was a Japanese...
I know Myers thought it was just really, really cool.
It was a Japanese group, and
Kyoto.
So what they did was they had these subjects looking at various images, very sort of simple images of letters or geometric shapes like a cross or a square or letters like N-E-U-R-O-N. Those are the letters they actually used in this. And so I guess what they first did was they had these subjects in an MRI machine, an fMRI, which can take very close to real-time images of neural processing.
That's functional MRI. Is that what the S for?
Yeah, functional MRI. Sometimes I've seen it referred to as a fast MRI. But,
I'm looking now. I'm looking at Myers' post.
So
simple, just basic shapes and simple, kind of very schematized letters. So people are looking at these things, and then they're scanning part of their brain, the visual cortex?
Yeah, so they're scanning a part of the brain where initial neural processing takes place. So the light falls on the retina, which is just jam-packed with neurons, and it takes those signals, and the optical nerve delivers those signals to the visual cortex, which I think is at the back of the skull. And there are these very different levels of processing, starting with the most basic, which is called V1, and then I think it goes up to V2, V3, V4, and
Yeah. So this is like on, like maybe V1, you have neurons that can identify the existence of a line or a horizontal line or a vertical line, and then higher up, you know, these feed into like something that does a higher level of abstraction until you get shape recognizers and things.
Yeah, and then there's
like that old Hubble and Wiesel experiment with the cats.
That's right, back in
way back.
The 1950s. So Hubble and Wiesel discovered that there were neurons that were that specialized in very specific functions, recognizing lines at a particular angle, recognizing a particular type of motion, and so then all these different pieces of information from a given visual scene had to be combined together. But what was remarkable about this study done by the Japanese is that I should have known this, that there is actually a kind of a map of an image that stays that is preserved through the initial parts of the image processing, and so you can get a kind of map in the V1 section of the visual cortex that corresponds to the image itself. And so the...
Yeah, so for example, like if you were looking at, say, a big cross, there would be a layer of your visual cortex in which neurons would be activated in the shape of a cross?
That wasn't clear.
That's what wasn't clear to me, because...
Now, apparently there's a lot of processing that's going on.
I start getting really suspicious when they start talking about complex pattern recognition and information processing algorithms, and it always makes me wonder. And it wasn't clear from P.Z. Meyer's post just what this was. He described it as a fair amount of math has to be flung at the scan to extract the contrast information.
Yeah.
And I really wondered what that meant, so then I noticed he didn't have a link to the paper, and then when I started Googling it, I realized why, because all you can get, was it published in Neuron, I think?
Yes.
All you can get is just the most useless abstract, and you try to download the article, and they want $30.
Yeah.
Stupid. If this were available to us for free, we could be talking knowledgeably about it, and it would be to the great credit of the... of neuroscience and spreading the word of this brilliant experiment. But it's
he's getting pretty good play as it is with between P.Z. Meyers and now, of course, George.
Well, yeah,
and John,
but I still don't understand. I don't know if I'm impressed by it or not, because I don't know what this information processing algorithm is, and if I can actually think of it, the implication is that we can think that there's this little scrap of the brain that. Is activated in an X-like pattern, but all I can really see from the description is that there's some unique activation that corresponds somehow to this cross on some kind of mapping. And that to me is completely unsurprising.
What it reminds me of,
I'm missing something.
It's exploiting a phenomenon called retinotopy. Which PZ defines as direct mapping of the spatial arrangement of the retina onto a patch of the brain at the back of your head. What this reminds me of is...
Well, it's like your skin is mapped onto parts of your brain, so you can actually, like those old experiments with Wilder Penfield, where, the open brain experiments with surgical patients, where you could actually show that, like, your hand is, mapped in a one-to-one correspondence, with a scrap of your cortex somewhere, so that if you're holding a cup in your hand, this is sort of, reproduced, by patterns of neural activation.
Yes.
So this also happens in the visual cortex, is what?
Right.
But was that not known before?
It says that the phenomenon of retinotopy was known. I think maybe this had been explored with electrodes implanted in the brains of animals before.
Yeah.
But I think maybe the most significant aspect of it is to show the level of detail that can be revealed by magnetic resonance imaging.
As a tour de force of brain scanning technology, it's impressive, but that's as far as it impressed me, but probably just through sheer ignorance, because so little information is given about it. Was anything written about this in the science press? This is a perfect case where you need a really good science journalist.
There was actually a much
read
more...
Read the paper and interview people and then explain what this means.
There was a more detailed piece on it in... on another science blog's site called Neurophilosophy. I don't know who writes this, but it's just got a little bit more
I'll take a look at that.
Information
about
it.
It'd be a perfect article for Science Times or Scientific American website.
I guess the problem with this story is it presents a very kind of cartoonishly simple picture of how vision works in the brain.
Yeah.
And, things are a lot more complicated than this one simple experiment would suggest. And, if you read this, you would think, for example, that creating an artificial vision system for blind people would be fairly simple. Scientists have actually been working on this for decades, where you take a camera somebody is blind, whether because of a problem with the eye itself or with the brain, the section of the brain where vision processing takes place. But so you can have a prosthesis that takes signals from a camera and feed it into the retina itself or the optic nerve or the visual cortex. And all these approaches have been tried, and it just doesn't work very well. And, you know, they've been working on this since really about the early 60s. And because there are complexities in vision processing that are that sort of defy engineers at this point in a way that you don't see, for example, in auditory processing. So artificial cochleas are quite successful. They work very well. They're very functional. People can have a conversation by telephone with an artificial cochlea. There's nothing remotely resembling that when it comes to vision prostheses. All right, anyway, so we fulfilled
so we discharged our responsibility, and it is, you know, it seems potentially fascinating. And I mean, just looking at the Myers reproduced a diagram from the paper in which they show the word neuron spelled out in block letters, and then the resulting activation, in which you can see little sort of, you know, rough, fuzzy N-E-U-R-O-N. But again, I don't know what that means and what kind of processing, you know, there was, and, you know, noise removal and image enhancement in order to do that. So it's really hard to evaluate, I think.
Well, you know, the...
You get a perfect place where a journalist... This is exactly why science journalism is so important, and it was exactly why I found there was this... You know, there's some interlopers doing Science Saturday a couple of weeks ago. And did you see that one? It was someone named Abigail Smith.
Oh, yes.
And Ed Yong.
Yes.
Oh, it was just exasperating. It was one of the most exasperatingly ignorant discussions of science journalism that I can imagine.
Well,
sorry, but...
This
Abigail
is more
Smith
of
apparently
the
has some kind of blog called ERV.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's just going on and on about, oh, the science journalists, you know, they, you know, they're so stupid and they misrepresent our work and they hype it. And, you know, I don't know if she's talking about, you know, she had a bad experience with, you know, the Wichita, you know, Beacon Journal or something. But, you know, when you think of all the first-rate neuroscience journalism that's being done by people like Sandra Blakesley or molecular biology by Nicholas Wade and... Or Benedict Carey at the Times, and I'm just, you know, mentioning people I know, but, you know, these people are brilliant at this, serving this huge purpose, and then she's grumbling about how it's really better for the scientists to be, you know, writing about their own work, which, of course, you know, is an important, you know, thing for scientists to be doing. But then, you know, basically, you'd come away from this discussion between Abigail Smith and Ed Yong thinking that the purpose of a science journalist was to be like a scribe or a stenographer, and you're supposed to go sit before the scientists,
a publicist,
and have them say what you want to put into words, since they seem to not be able to do this, and put into the paper to advertise their research so that they can get more, you know, federal money and grants. And you're not supposed to be at all critical, you're not allowed to interpret. And then there was something about, you know, sometimes the message that we want to get across, the journalist doesn't get it. Well, maybe it's because your message is self-serving, or maybe because the journalist often has more context than you have, you know, stuck in your little rat hole of a laboratory.
Jesus, George!
I'm sorry, this really annoyed me. And
I guess it did.
I looked at her blog today, and it was just you know, she's bragging about the fact that she can't write.
Uh-huh.
And she thinks somehow that what these blogs are doing is replacing science journalism. You know, for example, I'll give a link to this, but she, like, here's one of her posts. It starts out, "Sigh, my swooning over Ventnor on the cover of the latest edition of Seed was rudely interrupted by Larry Moran. Evidently, he really does get Seed for the articles. Heh, H-E-H. This article is not helpful for you or me or the scientific literacy we are fighting for." Literacy. "If someone held a gun to my head and screamed, 'Define epigenetics,' this is what I would say. histone and DNA modifications that alter chromatone structure, and then an arrow pointing to the word gene expression. Some people also include S is a subscript iRNA. Ah, I mean, just crystal clear. Yeah.
Wow, I mean, you are in a
you know, these
fine
blogs are just
mood,
written.
George.
You know, I mean, I'm sure a blog is very useful for the people in her profession to exchange ideas, but it's no substitute for the profession of science journalism. And I wouldn't be, this wouldn't make me so angry if she or he had expressed the slightest recognition of this. And
yeah.
It's just appalling. And then if she wasn't presenting herself as this champion of scientific literacy for the public.
They're probably just trying to boost their own traffic by saying things that will piss off eminent science journalists like you, George. And then we're going to post a link.
Again, it's this jet lag, you know.
No, that's great.
Not so irascible.
I feel like usually I'm the crank in this show, so... I'm glad to hear you go off after somebody.
Oh, well, thanks, John.
And you did it very eloquently. Now I feel like I have to go back and watch this train wreck of a conversation between these two people, or not. Hey, I'd like to mention something before we're done.
Oh my God! Something nice. Burned up 50 minutes.
A really wonderful science writer who is a scientist, a neurologist, actually, Oliver Sacks. He visited Stevens earlier this month to
wonderful
to give. Actually, it wasn't a talk. We had a sort of he wanted to have a public conversation instead of just giving a conventional lecture.
Oh, so how did you do that? Were you on like on stage with him? And
I had done the same thing with Steve Pinker almost exactly a year.
Yeah,
earlier.
I watched that one. Yeah,
and
that's
it was,
right.
So we talked about primarily about Sachs's book, Musicophilia, which came out about a year ago and is now out in paperback, and it's filled with all these stories about. The neural underpinnings of music and all these strange forms of amusia, which are disorders of the music capacity in humans. So it's a classic Sachs book. It's got a lot of wonderful
where you
stuff
get these bizarre cases that read like, you know, these wonderful little stories. And
yeah, so what's interesting about Sachs, and actually he has discussed this explicitly sometimes, is that he is averse to theory. He's sort of the opposite of a reductionist, and
he's not really a scientist.
Well, he would be annoyed,
a psychiatrist,
to hear you say that. But I think he's just a very different kind of scientist. So
scientists are
sort of reductionists by definition. They are looking for the commonalities, general principles underlying very disparate things. Sachs is saying, just in his style of writing, these stories that he tells about individuals, that individuals, even with very well-known brain disorders and diseases and so forth, are irreducible to some extent. Each person is absolutely unique.
Yeah, right, but that's in a way exactly the opposite of the scientific
It's the opposite of reductionism.
Yeah. I misspoke. I said that he was a psychiatrist. He's a neurologist.
Yes, a neurologist.
And what's so interesting is that there's this whole, I mean, neurology is almost its own separate culture, you know, going back to the days of, you know, Ramón y Cajal, the great Spanish neurologist, and Luria, the Russian.
Yes.
You know, and there was this tradition of, like, Luria wrote the book called Mind of a Numinist.
That was,
you know, the numinist was like this kind of carnival-like guy who could remember amazing amounts of detailed information. But then, as was described by Luria, that he was cursed with never being able to forget anything, and that every little detail, when that impinged on his senses, was supposedly recorded in his brain, which I doubt was quite true. But again, the whole spirit was not to analyze and reduce, but it was like every patient is an individual. Every case is completely different. And it's almost like Clifford Geertz and his, you know, thick description in Anthropology.
It's very much
so
like
your,
that.
So your drive isn't to synthesize and to come up with general rules so much as it is to just document the, just the irreducible diversity of mankind.
But that in itself is a profound truth. So, you know, there's this whole question over
it's just not science.
What makes humans or the human mind in particular different from other aspects of nature. It's just sort of resistant to scientific reductionism.
Yeah, and it's because, great to be reminded of that.
It's because the uniqueness of each person is so fundamental to our humanity. And so the scientists who try to reduce the mind to common principles are missing something really essential
That has to be the dominant drive to both reduce and to generalize if you're really going to get anything resembling a rough understanding and an ability to intervene when there's trouble.
Sachs had, so he's sort of anti-theory, and he says, that people have sometimes said, where's your big theory? You're just telling stories. And he has said, well, this is what I like to do, and I think it's an important function. But he actually has a really, I think you could call it a theory of everything in this book, which he sort of cobbles together from the work of others. And I'm sure there are many precedents for it, but I hadn't seen it put together in such an eloquent way. It's sort of seeing rhythm as a binding force at all scales of human experience.
Rhythm.
So
patterns in time.
Yeah. So one of the people that Sachs cites is a guy named Merlin Donald, who wrote a book called The Origin of the Modern Mind. I think that's the title of it. And in that book, Merlin says that the origins of human culture trace back to our mimetic capacity. So when we started, humans developed this capacity for seeing somebody, one proto-human sees somebody else doing something and we'll imitate it. And Donald said that the quintessential mimetic skill is a rhythmic skill. So rhythm is a kind of mimesis. And so he says that he thinks that music, that some kind of musical communication probably preceded modern language. Language evolved out of music and rhythm. So Sachs cites this, and then he talks of, his book is filled with all these instances of how rhythm binds together broken brains and minds. So there are people with Parkinson's disease, which is a, sort of a disconnect between mind and body and motor function. Mm. And there are people who have really lost control of their movements because their Parkinson's disease is so severe, but when they are singing or listening to music, they can dance and they can regain a lot of their motor function, and they can they can move much more smoothly. There are also people whose memories have been really severely eroded by Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, and they get a kind of memory back. Their brains get sort of in a rhythm through when they're listening to music or even performing music, and they are a lot of their functioning is restored. So there's this sort of cultural and social level also of music binding together people in a society. Wow. Music binds the pieces of broken minds together. And then Sachs also cites the synchronous oscillation theory of Francis Crick.
Crick, yeah, I was just going to ask. Francis Crick and Christoph Koch's thing about the binding problem.
Right. And so even at that very elemental sort of neural level, you have these rhythmic oscillations of neurons that are binding together the different parts of a perception or a thought to create this sense of wholeness that we have in our minds.
Yeah, that all sounds true.
Yeah.
I mean, with Crick and Koch, it was a certain frequency.
Yeah, 40 hertz oscillations. And actually...
And then by the binding problem, I mean, you know, trying to explain how... You know, all of our senses are getting these different streams of information, and yet somehow, after all this processing, we come up with a sense or an illusion of, you know, this coherent single, you know, kind of perceptual world. And how this is bound together in their theory is with these 50 hertz resonances, right?
Yes, oscillations at all different frequencies throughout the brain, but.
Okay.
I think there were 40 hertz oscillations were thought to be
40.
Thought to be key somehow. And
and of course ever since they, you know, been doing electroencephalography, you know, they've been known that they're, you know, the theta rhythms and the beta rhythms and the alpha rhythms and
and then I realized that an article that I clipped a few weeks ago out of the Science Times is related to this whole theory of everything. This is a piece that that your good friend Sandy Blakesley did for the Science Times, a profile of Rudolfo Linus, the NYU neuroscientist. And this is about how he thinks that lots of brain disorders, including Parkinson's, schizophrenia, depression, are caused by arrhythmia or dysrhythmia. Mm-hmm. In certain parts of the brain, especially in the thalamus, which sort of creates these oscillations that, again, serve to bind together different functions of the brain. And sometimes these oscillations, I guess it's almost like a kind of a clock mechanism in a computer. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these go awry, and it has really profound effects on cognition that can be manifested in something like depression or schizophrenia. So rhythm is the
rhythm.
Key to
you gotta have rhythm.
Yeah.
Boy, what's that? Yeah, that George Gershwin song from Porgy and Bess. Da, 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 da. Anyway. I'm thinking more about what you said about Sachs and this idea of, you know, every patient's an individual and kind of a resistance to reduction, and I'm thinking even, you know, his book Uncle Tungsten.
Yeah.
You know, which is his memories of growing up and learning about chemistry as a boy, and it's just one of my favorite books. And again, it's almost like he describes each element as though it's an individual.
Yeah.
You know, with the personality, and it's just that same. Wow.
Yeah, he's a remarkable person. He's really.
That's so cool that you have this. You know, that you've gotten this thing going at Stevens, which is entirely, you know, your own initiative to. Bring these people there. And
well, I just try to bring people there whose company I think I would enjoy. Like
you,
George.
Yeah, you get George. To hang out with them, and then, you know, they get to expose their ideas to all these smart people. And
you're my first speaker, my first invited speaker.
I forgot about that.
You set
back
the bar.
When I was plugging Miss Leavitt's stars, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
You even gave me a little money, as I recall.
You set the bar very high. Yeah, don't say that, though, because we don't have any money anymore.
Oh, no, yeah, nobody does.
Nobody's getting any money.
Yeah.
We're all doing it for free.
I wanted to ask you one. Well, yeah, before we. I just wanted to ask you one quick question.
Sure.
It probably doesn't have a quick answer, so we should probably do another segment on this sometime else. But did Sachs, or does his book give any insight into, you know, what how in the world music. Evolved, since there doesn't seem to be any, you know, obvious survival aspect for it. Was it an epiphenomenon, or
well, as I said,
does he have thoughts on that? I mean, sure he does.
He refers to these theories. So Steve Pinker, apparently in How the Mind Works, speculates that music was kind of a spandrel, this byproduct. The language function, so language preceded music, but then
a spandrel. Without getting into the details, it's an architectural metaphor for this idea of something kind of emerging from something else. I mean, so there's something that's there for a function, or, you know, that's selected by evolution, and then as kind of a byproduct, you get something like music.
That's right. And so that was Pinker's idea, and Pinker actually calls music biologically useless, and Sachs quoted him saying that, and apparently Pinker wrote Sachs a letter and said he was taken out of context and so forth. But anyway...
They're both kind of regulars in the New York Review of Books, right?
So they
battle out in the pages. But there's another neuroscientist, William Calvin?
Yes.
At the University of Washington, and he has some theories about music and, being something, I think, an epiphenomenal thing that somehow arose out of the evolutionary advantage of being able to develop precise, like, timing when you're throwing a spear or something.
Oh, God.
I read this so long ago that I don't remember. I'm sure I'm not doing justice to his argument.
Sachs doesn't mention that. He does mention a book called The Singing Neanderthals by a British either archaeologist or anthropologist named Steve Mithen. And Mithen, I'm not sure where his evidence comes from, but... he says that he thinks that the original sort of primeval language was a kind of combination of song and language. Again, it was something to which that
which
we're the
a lot of people, like with Homer's Odyssey, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and it kind of fits in with some other ideas that I've read by some literary critics.
But actually...
Yeah, we should do more on this, because there's like a book that came out recently called Your Brain on Music.
Yeah.
And some follow-up. I haven't read any of those, but I think they're around the house. But this makes me want to look into this more. And
there is a lot to say. Actually, I'll just mention one other thing. So Sachs was talking about the evolution of language, and he's music and rhythm, or our sensitivity to rhythm. And he said something that really surprised me, that there are no non-human animal antecedents of music. And he said there have been no cases in which animals have been observed keeping time with music, moving in time, or with any kind of sort of rhythmic sound. We have an African gray parrot who every time we put on, not every kind of music, but music with a real strong beat, especially Motown and especially Aretha Franklin, he bobs his head up and down in time to the music.
Whoa.
And I told Sachs this, and he was very intrigued by it, and he said the question would be, the problem is that sometimes Susie and I, or the rest of us in the family, are also bobbing our heads up and down.
So it could be mimetic.
It could be visually mimetic.
Visually mimetic.
But actually, we just tested it recently. I put on some Aretha Franklin, and then just, I wasn't in the room where he was, and I poked my head around the corner, and there Mario was, bobbing his head up and down in time with the music.
Wow.
So, but that the problem is, it is a parrot. Which is mimicking others.
You got to do it with a raven or a crow or one of those horrible swans that you have around there.
Anyway, we could.
I guess you write it up, John.
we'll talk about it. We could.
Yeah, that sounds good.
It's a rich topic.
Yeah. So, are you on Christmas vacation now?
Yes, I am.
From school. Good.
I have my Christmas party at Stevens actually tomorrow, but other than that, I've got a break of about another month or so.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, maybe we'll get together again on Science Saturday before the new year or soon after.
It sounds good.
I'm around for the duration.
Okay. Yeah, welcome back. Okay. I'm glad you made it back after your travails overseas.
Yeah, it's good to be home, as much as I liked Spain particularly.
All right, man.
We'll see you soon. Have a Merry Christmas and all that, and good solstice.
Same to you.
Okay, bye,
John. Talk to you later.